So I'm going to jump into questions. I'm going to start first. I won't say who submitted them unless Adam, we're good. Okay. I won't say who submitted them. I'm just going to jump in. Some of them are longer than others because they're scenarios, so we kept them tried to stay true to how they were submitted out of transparency. The first question was, why was the distance cut to 3 feet for students to sit without masks, and do I agree with that? Initially, you are correct. There was a lot of guidance that was 6 feet, 6 feet, 6 feet, and as we looked at that, we're like, we're not going to school. If it's 6 feet, we're not going to school. Well, then guidance came out from different entities that said 3 to 6 feet. So then we were seeing a 3 to 6 feet shuffle from feds, from, you know, we were looking at our guidance that we were like what we were going to follow. The American Academy of Pediatrics also had put some things out about now more of a 3 feet. So we're following the guidance that is medical and science and nature. If that is incorrect, I am not one to question that. That's not my role, but whatever we are provided, schools, I will tell you, are trying their hardest to get as much distance as possible. So the 3 feet is the minimum, but I have visited schools prior to them starting to see the setups. I have talked to many of them on the phone. They are trying their hardest to get at least a minimum of 3 feet, if not more. It is difficult when you are dealing with a five-year-old. It is difficult when you're dealing with a 15-year-old. And so having said all that, that distance piece is a struggle. What I have heard mainly is, for all kids, not just 3 through high school, many of our districts, all students, they're really asking them to mask up. And for the 3-8 that it's mandatory, and then for the littler students, the K to 2, many of them are still being very diligent in making sure those masks are on. From what I've heard, many of them are leaving them on for quite a bit of time. There's not a lot of taking them down unless they're eating or maybe they're doing something rigorous on the playground. They said they're in those masks quite a bit of the time. What I'm hearing is kids have done an amazing job adapting to that. Now, do you have those families or those students who you're going to have some conversations with that don't love that? Absolutely. So I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say it's perfect. But from what I'm hearing, it is done. Mainly our schools have done a really, really good job. And that goes back to families who are supporting that and goes back to kids who are a good partner. Having said that, I will say from some of our younger elementary grades, I am hearing that it takes a lot of time to reinforce how the mask should be worn as far as that nose covering, the mouth covering, or the hanging from your ear. So some of that is just a reminder. They're spending quite a bit of time reinforcing good mask, safe mask wearing. But we'll get there. It's going to take time. Many were on day one when they reported back to us. Some have been at it a while. So, but that has seemed to go better than some had expected, to be honest with you. So that piece of it, as far as the mask wearing and the distance, again, not perfect, but people are doing the best they can in order to accommodate this situation. Communities really are holding our schools accountable. So we have heard from a lot of community members that if their child goes to school or pictures are taken or stories are being shared. Now, sometimes, you have to filter through some of those, but we do follow up with some of those phone calls. We do share with districts some of the concerns that we're hearing. Listen to, obviously we want to hear their issues with it as well, or I hate to say this, but their side of it, to make sure that we are being, as diligent as possible to get the community person an answer or to put them in contact with each other is what happens a lot of times. But honestly, prior to school starting, those calls were quite a bit. The schools that have started, those have slowed down a little bit. So once school got started and I think students got in and people had a clear understanding of what that lunch was going to look like, what that pod meant, what recess meant, what the one flow hallways actually meant, that kids could, and the adaptations and accommodations that have been made for people, I think it put some of those concerns to rest. But again, not perfect, but it's going better than honestly many of us have expected it to go. Having said that, it says, should there be a level for the number of cases that would mean a school to shut down. So I'm kind of bouncing around here because we didn't bucket these by flow. We bucketed them by the reporter who asked, or the media person who asked. So should there be a level for the number of cases that would mean schools should shut down? So out of the gate with in-class, our schools were very adamant. They wanted mitigation thresholds. So if we have that for measles, if we have it for flu, you know, they wanted some thresholds. And I understand, having been a principal, having been a superintendent, those are critical. They wanted those. Some of our districts have those now as far as levels of cases and what happens at those trigger holds. Not everybody has those, but we have had a lot of calls from superintendents, from nurses, from board members, from family, saying, where are those thresholds? We have asked about that. I know there's some hesitancy to set those based on regional trends, regional positivity rates, just who in those positivity rates, who are the positive and what's that look like? And obviously that's a whole, we don't have that data. That's obviously Department of Health and local departments of health. So I understand the reluctancy, but we do have a lot of superintendents who are still asking for that. That really is true, especially in some of those areas that things aren't looking great with numbers, that when you are the superintendent or the local superintendents who are trying to stay together, whether it's a county or by region, it sometimes is helpful to have that to fall back to have that science or that medical that's a little tighter. So I understand why they're asking. I also understand the other side of that as far as I've heard why. And so it's not like people are saying we're not doing it just because. There are some reasonings for that, but we are getting asked quite a bit about that. Parents also, too, are asking for that. Some of our parents are asking for more of a black and white, what can we expect if we are watching our trends go up and we know we hit, let's say, 7, and that triggers an elementary to close down. We know if those positivity rates that they can follow as well are not looking good, they know to start preparing. So we've also heard from some parents that are saying this is why we want them. So there are different sides of that that we are obviously listening to. Will schools be required to take part in state testing? That is a great question. If classes remain virtual and in a hybrid. So let me explain to you where we are with that. The department, obviously, again, more than medical going on right now, and this is one of those examples of that darn assessment sneaks up on everybody. So we are working on guidance. We have assessments that are right out of the gate. So we have a list of fall assessments that some of them happen 20 days after initial school starts on some of our special populations. Some of them are triggered by a move-in, like if a student with maybe who's identified as special education moves into a district. All of that is handled based upon whether it's a federal exam, whether it's a state exam, what's on the line for that exam. There are a lot of moving parts to this. Some of them at the local level give those assessments to get a baseline so we can gauge where kids are coming in, and then obviously it drives instruction. It gives us a better way to target that instruction, which is great, which we fully support. There are a lot of moving parts to this. We are struggling with, if students are virtual, how does that work with state mandated testing because of proctoring? How do you know who's actually taking that test? And it's very expensive to do a one-on-one proctor. Our virtual schools, when they go through that, they are made to find a site to actually, across the state, there are usually sites that are given for their families by the virtual school, and they have worked that out. They, too, struggle with that. That's not easy. Participation rates, at times, we've really struggled with that. At no fault of anyone, it's the nature of it. So that virtual proctoring is, one, sometimes not allowed. But two, how does that look to try to get those kids on site? If the families are like, my child is not coming in, I don't want them around people, but yet we're saying, but they have to come in for the statewide test and they're going to be in with all those kids, that's where the rub is coming. So we're working through all that. For some of the tests, we would need a waiver, a federal waiver, if we are pushing for that. In the state, we would need state legislation to help us with that, or the governor's office to help us with that. Right now, we have none of that. The feds aren't willing to pull that card yet, and we've not heard anything from our governor's office. I think part of it is waiting to see what happens with some of this. But we know, schools know, we don't have a whole lot of wait time here for fall, because if I'm giving iStep 10, which is a graduation requirement, in the fall, and that's the time my students are going to take it, because I'm going to have a lot of early grads this year, because we're hearing that as well, December grads. They got my credits. We're going to get them out of there from every lens. What happens with that? So we know we need answers sooner than later. The feds were putting together our recommendation because it's very hard to untie assessment to accountability. Accountability, we are having that conversation about waivers with the feds and what is our ask going to be, because that's in the department's control, which makes it a little easier. But anything outside of our control, it'll be a waiting game. So we have the fall tests ready. We're communicating guidance to the schools that we're meddling through that. But just know it's not that clean. But anything we can get waived this year as far as the assessments that are high stake for accountability obviously is going to be extremely important. I'm not sure how fair it is given the fluidity of this situation. What guidance have schools received on contact tracing? Now that we are seeing cases in schools that have reopened, that is a great question. So contact tracing by far is getting a lot of noise in our department because a lot of the superintendents, a lot of the nurses are just now hitting that point where they have positive cases because school has started. But honestly, we had this going on prior to school starting because we had either staff or we had students who were in for summer school or we had athletes or whatever the case may be. Coaches, administrators, you name it, we've had it all, that we've been put in that situation where it was contact tracing. That has been very, very difficult. The lag in testing can be tough. Also, just the nature of contact tracing. So I know Dr. Box has talked about this quite a bit, about it's good to have good partners with that, like family, like trying to plead with families to please participate with that. Here's what we're hearing from our families. They'll get a call. And basically our ask, I'm going to use my own child, are you Kale McCormick's mother, whose birthday is XYZ, and you have to say yes or no? And the parents usually hang up and call the school and say, I just got a weird call. I'm not sure who it was. I'm not sure if it was legit. Even if they identify themselves, parents are very reluctant to say, yes, my child is so-and-so, or Kale McCormick, who went to Yorktown High School and his birthday was X. I mean, that's a lot of information from where we're not sure. They're worried about the legitimacy of who's on that call and who's going to start taking advantage of those calls, like for what purposes. They're worried about where that's going to lead to. Will they start asking for verification on last four digits of social, different type of things? Was it positive? Those kind of things. That contact tracing when you're dealing with minors is tough. So schools have tried to be a good partner with that, but I will be honest with you, it is a lot. So if we have one positive, I've heard schools call and say, with that one positive, we had 48 kids to track down. That's a lot. So you're talking about capacity, and I know the Department of Health has hired contact tracers, but you're still at a capacity issue. So on top of the testing, on top of the contact tracing, those are the pieces that are tricky, at no fault really of anyone. It's just the nature of it. So when people think that's easy, it's not. So I'm not going to sugarcoat contact tracing. That is one we've had superintendents call that are like, really? They're trying to do the best they can and be good partners with their local health departments, but there's such a lag in that practice. The other piece of this is some schools have started out of the gate, put their children or students in pods per se. Like if I'm a first grade classroom, maybe on the playground, I'm in quadrant A. So I know those kids are kind of staying together. They're eating together. They're in pods per se. High schools have done the best they can. And so it was a middle school, but those pods, their kids can quickly morph. And so schools are really trying to figure out how do you tighten those down logistically with like physical barrier type of like ropes or different things to help with that situation. So some of that is just learning pains and schools are doing the best they can. But until sometimes you get thousands of kids come through your door, things change. But that contact tracing is very difficult. I know it can be frustrating. It is systemic. It's a willing participant type of, you have to have a family willing, the child willing, the school willing, a good contact tracer. I mean, it is a lot. So for people to downplay that or act like that's easy, it really is not. Testing is a huge part of that. So that quick turnaround time, the faster that is, the more success obviously schools are seeing with that. Has IDOE provided school districts guidance on crafting e-learning policies? That is a great question. So we created the template for the continuous learning plan guidelines that schools had to submit last spring in order to get kind of the waiver days attached to the governor's emergency or executive order, I'm sorry. And so we did that. That template was pretty solid. The policies are the same for virtual as they are for instructional time, whether it's on site with the academic engagement was required for attendance. They had to come up with their policy for that. So schools had some work to do as far as what does student engagement really look like? What does that attendance piece really look like? What is that completion rate looking like for, it's easier to do that with high school courses. But they did a lot of work and we provided a lot of assistance between then and now. So that has been quite busy. We also had best practices in the continuous learning plan that were included. We have provided resources for that. And many districts